We're in the 24th lesson in the book of Judges, and I want to invite you to open up your Bible to Judges chapter 12 and have it there ready for you. When we get to that point, we're going to actually look at the last part of verse number 4 to begin with. I want to remind you of where we were. Jephthah had defeated the Ammonites. He had had the little thing that happened with his daughter over a 2-month period, and lo and behold, the tribe of Ephraim's elders show up at his house in Zaphon in the land of Tob, threatened to burn his house down because they had been left out of the battle. Had they been left out of the battle, as we saw last week? Absolutely not. Jephthah had invited them and they had decided not to go. Nevertheless, in their argument back to Jephthah, they said this. They said, "You," talking to the Gileadites, the warriors, said, "You are fugitives of Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh." Now, when they say that, it is internal proof positive of what I addressed back in Judges chapter 7, verse 3, where if you remember, we were talking about Gideon, who was going to fight those Midianites in the valley of Jezreel. And what was going to happen was Gideon was going to cull down the number of the warriors. And in so doing, all he did was say to the troops, "Whoever is afraid of trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead." Well, the problem is, how could that be if you remember? Gideon was on Mount Gilboa. He was not on over in the land of Gilead. But we addressed the fact, did Gideon misspeak or did the writer miswrite? The answer is no. Because Mount Gilboa stands in the tribal area of Manasseh. And as I stated back in the commentary back then in Judges chapter 7, verse 3, it was highly, highly appropriate for Gideon to use the word Gilead, because Gilead was the largest troop or largest clans of the had the largest number of troops among those who were from the tribes of Manasseh on both sides of the Jordan River. And so, because there were Gileadites living on the east side in the land of Manasseh, in the land of Ephraim, there were also Gileadites living over in the land of Gilead, because they named the east side Gilead as a nickname. They named the west side Machor as a nickname, but they could have just as well swapped the names and called the west side Gilead and the east side Machor. They could have done that too. And so Gideon nicknamed that area, that Mount Gilboa, Mount Gilead, because the majority of the troops there were probably from Gilead, because it was the largest of the tribes at that time. So those who were afraid, they could leave. Now, we want to look at these words that were said at the end of verse number 4 by the men of Ephraim, when they said they were fugitives in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh. In other words, these Gileadites were fugitives in the midst. And here's the proof pudding in the pudding. The Ephraimites, whose land was carved out of the land given to Manasseh by Joshua. Joshua gave the land to Manasseh first, and then he carved out Ephraim's land inside that land. We are finding that these Ephraimites are admitting that the descendants of Gilead were living on both sides of the Jordan River. Specifically, descendants of Gilead were living on the west side of the Jordan River in the tribal area of Manasseh, which has included the area down below called the tribal area of Ephraim. But they were also the Ephraimites. They call them fugitives because they're on the east side too. Now, what does that mean, being a fugitive? In the Hebrew, a fugitive is a person who roves or wanders as a refugee would do. In most cases, they are fleeing some form of evil. And in this case, the Ephraimites call these Gileadites fugitives because some of those fighting with Jephthah, were natives on the west side of the Jordan River rather than on the east side where they were with Jephthah. In other words, men of Ephraim who were Gileadites were there fighting with Jephthah. And what is Ephraim trying to do, the elders of Ephraim? They are trying to divide the loyalty of the troops. It is for that reason that the men of Gilead from both sides had joined together in solidarity at this point in time in the story, and they are going to defeat Ephraim. That statement was the writer's first pass on this storytelling of the defeat of Ephraim. But the writer is now going to make a second pass through that story to tell us how Gilead, or the Gileadites, defeated Ephraim. And even though Ephraim accused the Gileadites of being fugitives over in Ephraim, the Gileadites' response is going to turn that around and make Ephraim fugitives in the land of Gilead. And we see that in verse number 5. And that's very common, where a person turns a statement around back on the person who said it to begin with. Verse 5. The Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan opposite Ephraim. And it happened when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And if he said no, then they would say to him, "Say now, Shibboleth." But he said, "Sibboleth," for he could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. Thus there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. Okay, what it's telling us is that warriors of Ephraim are stranded on the far side of the east side of the Jordan River and are trying to get home on the west. There are these fords in this river, and the Gileadites have taken them, and they're waiting for the Ephraimites to try to get back into the land, tribal area of Ephraim. Now, all the tribes of Israel were cousins, remember that, and they all had the same skin tone, and they all looked alike. However, how would the Gideonites' warriors determine who was an Ephraimite? Well, the answer is in the pronunciation of one word. They were keen on this. The word was Shibboleth. Even though the tribes were all cousins and they all spoke the same language, they all did not speak the same dialect. I want to give you an example. One of my dearest friends over the last 30 years, who is now in heaven, his name was Wally Chetty. His real name was Tongchin Chetty, and he was from British Guiana. English was his native tongue, but it was not American English, and it surely was not South Texas English, where we are in Houston. The last four digits of Wally's phone number were 3333. But Wally, with his British Guianan dialect, would not let him say 3333. No matter how hard he tried, he always said, "tree, tree, tree, tree." With all his might, he could not make his tongue say the TH sound in the word three, or the TH sound in any of the other words. Now in Guyana, they would laugh at us for pronouncing it three when everyone in the country pronounced it tree. That same problem occurred with the Ephraimites. With all their might and with all their power, their tongue could not pronounce the SH in the word Shibboleth. It was a sure audible sign that identified a person as being a member of the Ephraimite tribe. It also brought them death at the fords of the river. Thus, it says, there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. It doesn't say on that day like the writer normally says. It says at that time. In other words, it was a time when these Ephraimite warriors were fugitives over in Gilead, and they were trying to get home, and 42,000 of them could not make it. 42,000 went to defeat Jephthah, but they lost their lives. With that said, we come to Jephthah's tenure as the judge of Israel in verse number 7. Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah, the Gileadite, died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. In other words, he was not taken back to his home in the land of Tob and Zaphon. He died in Gilead, where he was a chief judge. For 6 years, Jephthah kept Israel safe, that region safe, the Gilead area safe from the oppression of surrounding nations. Adding 6 years to the time Jephthah led the battle to defeat the Ammonites, we can determine that 312 years have now passed over the time since it was time when Moses let the nation of Israel go and go in with Joshua to take the land, because they had said 300 years had passed. Now it was time. 306 years have now passed. After announcing the time served as judge and the death of Jephthah, the writer presents three regular minor judges of Israel, all in the regular magistrate system set in place during the days of Moses for the Promised Land. Enter Ibzan into verse number 8. Now Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters whom he gave in marriage outside the family. And he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. Then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. Now a valid discussion can be read among the scholars of the past concerning Ibzan's 7 years of work as a judge in Israel. And in short, some say that Ibzan being in Bethlehem cannot be the Bethlehem of Judea, which is the birthplace of Jesus, because Judah was basically isolated from all the struggles that came from all the oppressive nations. But that doesn't make sense to me, because back in chapter 10, verse 9, we learn that the tribe of Judah was oppressed by the Ammonites, which resulted in the judgment at the hands of Jephthah. Because of that fact, it would have been Bethlehem of Judah. It had to be. But be that as it may, it could have been Bethlehem of Ephrathah. We learn of that city over in Micah 5:1. Or it could be Bethlehem of Zebulun up north. We found about that city up in Joshua chapter 19, verse 15. There are three Bethlehems that exist in the Promised Land at the same time. But we are hard-pressed to determine here the true Bethlehem mentioned, but it just seems like Bethlehem of Judah is the correct one. Judah is down to the south. And just over to the west is the Philistines, who were in alignment with oppressing the nation of Israel. Why wouldn't it be Bethlehem of Judah? Next, as with Tola and Jair, if you remember, with whom in context seemed to have served at the same time, with Tola in the west Promised Land and Jair in the east Promised Land, it appears that Ibzan may have come into office after Jephthah became the judge in Gilead on the east side of the Jordan River and served congruently on the west side of the Jordan River in the area of Judea. Why not? Because Jephthah was protecting Gilead, Ibzan would be protecting Judah down south on the other side of the river. Jephthah would die after 6 years. Ibzan would die after 7 years. The reason for this thought is found in the analysis of the phrase, "Now Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him," with a focus on, I want to focus on the word after. In our Western mindset, we automatically conclude that Jephthah had to die before Ibzan became judge. But that is not the case with this writer. As we have seen in this book many times, the writer will finish a story with the death of a person, like he did with Joshua in the very beginning chapter of the book, and then he'll come back and tell more of the story and end with the death of Joshua again. And Joshua didn't die twice. That seems to be the case here. Jephthah became the judge, and then Ibzan became a judge after Jephthah came into office. Not after he died, but after he came into office. But it does not mean Jephthah had died yet, and here is the reason why. The Hebrew word translated after can mean after the manner of or in the order of. In other words, Ibzan became a judge just as Jephthah became a judge. Now, where's the proof in that? Wycliffe, in his translation, used the word after in this verse. However, when we check out the Old English language of his day, of Wycliffe's day, because Wycliffe was using as close of word as he could use in his day to match the Hebrew word in Scripture. In his day, the definition for the word after simply meant later in time or subsequent in time. It did not mean after the death. It just means subsequent or later. Therefore, it is acceptable to interpret the writer's intent to imply that Ibsen became a judge following the time that Jephthah became a judge without the need to wait for his death. Now, with Jephthah judging in the normal magistrate system on the east side of the Jordan River for 6 years after he'd eliminated the oppression and saved Israel from the Ammonites, and that was all gone, it seems advantageous to have Ibsen judging in the regular magistrate system down on the west side of the Jordan River to the south in the area of Judah. Furthermore, why would the writer mention this judge at this time unless he was the judge who helped protect the nation of the Ammonite, to protect the nation from the Ammonite and possibly the Philistine oppression in Judah? Because the Ammonites had gone down into Judah too, and Benjamin and Ephraim, if you remember. The reason for the mention of this minor judge from the magistrate system probably had nothing to do with the oppressive nations. It had to do with his sin that he perpetrated in his family. We saw it in the text, but you probably missed it. But here it is again. It said he had 30 sons and 30 daughters whom he gave in marriage, where? Outside the family, and he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. The judge broke the law by marrying his 30 sons and 30 daughters to non-Israelite spouses. These spouses came from outside the family of Israel, which is a sin. Here is the law in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 through 6 that proves that. When the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Gershites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and I will quickly destroy you. But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their asherim and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possessions out of all the people who are on the face of the earth. Ibsen broke this law. The writer probably inserted the name of Ibsen in this passage, one of the minor magistrate's judges, because of the marriages he garnered for his family. He contributed to the sin of Israel, which would lead to the final sixth cycle of the sin of Israel against the Lord. The worship of false gods and graven images of Baal and Asherah is idolatry. More than likely, Ibsen served his 7 years in the magistrate system in the tribal area of Judah, where the Philistines, who helped the Ammonites' oppression, were just a few miles to the west. Most likely, Ibsen was judging in that southern area of Judah, and Elon was judging in the magistrate system in the north. In the tribal area of Zebulun, enter Elon, Israel's judge for 10 years, verse 11. Now Elon, the Zebulunite, judged Israel after him, and he judged Israel 10 years. Then Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried in Ajalon, in the land of Zebulun. Notice the writer tells us nothing but where Zebulun lived and where he was buried. What good did that do to this story? Only one thing. The writer is telling us that shortly after Jephthah became the judge in Gilead, Ibsen became the judge in Judah, and after Ibsen became the judge in Judah, shortly after, Elion became the judge in Zebulun, and he served in that position for 10 years. Therefore, the east side of the Jordan was judged by Jephthah. The southern portion on the west side of the Jordan was judged by Ibsen. And the northern portion of the promised land on the west side of the Jordan was judged by Elion. What was missing? Well, I want to tell you this. The Lord does not ever disappoint. He has the writer fill in the gap, which was lacking. Enter Abdon, Israel's judge for 8 years. Verse 13. Now Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pathrianite, judged Israel after him. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Parathionite, died and was buried at Parathon in the land of Ephraim, in the hill country of the Amalekites. The name Abdon means servant. However, the name Hillel means to praise. And the name Parathionite means native or dweller. Therefore, Abdon was a judge who served with praise, dwelling in the tribal area of Ephraim. This tribal area sits in the middle of the Promised Land on the western side of the Jordan River. For all practical purposes, the Promised Land had a strong judge in the regular magistrate system in the north, central, and south on the west side of the Jordan River in the Promised Land, and in the upper central section of the eastern Promised Land on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, the mention of the donkeys in this case is the same as the mention of the donkeys that were ridden by Jair's sons, if you remember. The riding of the donkey was a sign of distinguished rank in those times when the Israelites had no horses. Horses would come into the land of Israel later, but not until the time of Solomon. And even though David would have a few horses, the law prohibited Israel from having great herds of horses. Israel was never to have the herd, great herds of horses. In a prophecy delivered from Moses, Israel is told that one day in the Promised Land, the nation will set its heart to have a king instead of allowing the Lord to be its king. In Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, we hear about that. And here's how it goes. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your countrymen who shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return again that way. But the desire for a king is still a few years away from this time in the story in the book of Judges. For now, if they had horses, they were few. Donkeys, on the other hand, were plentiful and were highly esteemed. Finally, in this passage, we learn that Abdon judged in the area inhabited by the Amalekites. This entry is simply for location purposes only because at this time in the story, the Amalekites no longer live on the land. However, previously, the Amalekites, when they were aligned with Eglon, the king of Moab, and they were oppressing the land, the Amalekites lived there. But during the oppression, the Amalekites had inhabited, the Amalekites inhabited the surrounding area in the eastern sections of the tribe of Ephraim, the tribe of Benjamin. If any Amalekites remained in the land, they were few. Therefore, Abdon served as a praise judge in that area in Ephraim. If these judges served in the four areas of the Promised Land semi-simultaneously, they were probably all dead within 12 years because they all died. We got that. We don't know how long they were there, but they all died before 12 years was up and had passed since the nation left with Joshua as their head. With these judges gone, Israel could fall into the sin against the Lord again, starting cycle 6 with the Philistine takeover that has already been brewing since their oppression of the Ammonites began. Yet, they were held back by Ibsen. Now, with the timing of these 312 years since the Exodus, since the time of Moses dying and being under the rule of Joshua, it fits nicely into the timing of the rest of the book of Judges and the decision to ask for a king over in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and the decision to select a king, King Saul. And by the fourth year of the reign of King Solomon, we learn that in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, that 480 years had passed to the day that Moses led Israel out of Egypt. We are at 312 years now. And I want you to know something for a fact. This fits nicely. When we add up the remaining years in the book of Judges, and we add up the years under the rule of Samuel as judge in the book of 1 Samuel, and when we add up the years of the reign of King Saul, and we add up the years of the reign of David, and then we get to the fourth year of the reign of King Solomon, when he begins and lays the cornerstone for the foundation of the temple. Altogether, it fits perfectly into the time that is left from 312 years to that time when we add it up back to the time they left Egypt. It's virtually perfect. And we'll find out more about that as we study again, picking up in chapter number 13 in the book of Judges in our next lesson, lesson number 25 of Judges.